putting a name to one Nigerian schoolgirl. Today, Tuesday, May 13th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Who exactly are the kidnapped Nigerian schoolgirls? One missing girl's father tells me about his lovable daughter. Also, could all the attention focused on the Nigerian drama actually backfire?
If we just sort of go in almost expecting to be a RoboCop to save the world, we're just going to make things worse for everyone involved.
Plus, a European court changes the rules on internet privacy.
If you have a problem with what gets returned on a search that involves your name, then you can ask a search engine like Google to remove it.
And mapping a city by smell.
The domineering smell of Edinburgh is actually the brewery.
Those stories after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube, all on the TiVo Romeo DVR, TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Bring back our girls, bring back our daughters. The hashtags have been helpful in making the kidnapping drama in northern Nigeria a global cause. But nothing's made the drama in Nigeria more real for me than talking today to the father of one of those abducted girls. Yabuku Nkeki's 19-year-old daughter, Soroti, was in the group of nearly 300 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram a month ago. Nkeki describes Soroti for me.
Actually, she's a lovable daughter. She's so friendly to everybody. She's also active in this volleyball. It's something that makes me cry every time.
He was hard to understand over the bad phone line, but you can hear him there saying how she's a lovable daughter, very friendly, and that he cries all the time for her. And Nkeki also said he's seen the video released by Boko Haram, supposedly showing about half of the missing girls, but he wasn't able to see his daughter in the crowd. He also said that security in his city, Chibok, was almost non-existent, despite the government declaring a state of emergency there.
If Nigeria government can do something, bring more security in Chibok area, imagine only 15 army controlling Chibok. We are always in fear.
Imagine that, always living in fear, on top of having your daughter abducted. I also spoke today with Malam Keri. He's a math and physics teacher at government secondary school Chibok, where the girls are kidnapped. He said he knows them all well, and that a student who was not taken helped him identify one of the girls in that video, the one who is doing most of the talking. Her name is Abdul, and Keri says she's a Christian who was apparently forced to convert to Islam.
Yes, Abdul was a Christian, but now, oh my God.
Keri told me that everyone in Chibok is still in shock over what's happening to the girls.
We are traumatized. Every day when we hear the news, and the news is still no sign of seeing them, we need your help.
The fate of the Nigerian girls remains front and center for the international media. They're being pushed in part by the prominence of the story on social media, and that's being pushed by the Bring Back Our Girls hashtag. But not everyone believes all this global attention is a good thing.
I'm really not against this outrage, because how can you not be outraged? It's obviously an awful human tragedy. But just sort of waving technology or waving soldiers or sending soldiers unilaterally or just kind of making a big public relations campaign out of it ourselves, I don't think that's helpful.
That's Zeynep Tufekci of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We speak with her regularly about issues related to the internet and society. And Tufekci says the global hashtag campaign may be helping to make this crisis even more complex.
Internationalizing in this manner, especially if it becomes wrapped up in sort of these larger questions of, say, Al-Qaeda or other topics that aren't really related to this problem at hand, it can potentially create an environment in which the girls' lives and the future of, you know, people in that region are more in peril, because now all of a sudden they have become pawns in a bigger game, and this group, this terrorist group, Boko Haram, is now reeled in, quote-unquote, the great Satan. And what would be dangerous is if policy gets overdetermined by people with other agendas, with big powers, and in ways that don't empower Nigerians, who are the only people who can solve this problem.
Do you think the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls campaign has been driving policy?
The hashtag campaign has been somewhat driving policy. Just this morning in an online publication, Politico, which is read widely in Washington, D.C., I read an article that was saying Boko Haram is connected to the Benghazi and it's connected to Al-Qaeda. This should be all part of this global war on terror. And I was just shaking my head, to be honest, somewhat scared that a local problem that Nigerians can only solve can be so quickly wrapped up into people's domestic agendas for what they want done. And if that kind of thinking takes hold, it'll be bad for Nigeria, it'll be bad for the United States, because once again, it's a local problem that can only be solved by Nigerians.
I mean, if you look at the narrative of the hashtag, though, it's not like Nigerians planned this out. It seemed to start there and then got picked up by the likes of Michelle Obama and Malala Yousafzai and then female senators on Capitol Hill. And then things started and seemed to get kicked in to high gear at the White House and this now military attention with Nigeria. I mean, could you argue that this attention could ultimately weaken Boko Haram?
The attention within Nigeria and the condemnation could definitely weaken Boko Haram. Attention has been known to smother terrorist groups. You know, in Egypt, a Luxor bombing by an Islamic terrorist group was so loudly condemned within Egypt that the group just lost all support. In Turkey, Al-Qaeda bombings, one of a synagogue, were condemned so loudly within Turkey that, you know, it just kind of ended any propaganda effort Al-Qaeda might have tried in the country. What's dangerous is that the kind of attention that can smother Boko Haram, which is attention within Nigeria, and of course global condemnation is fine, could be countered if they get a new unpopular enemy that they can pretend they're fighting against, or that they can create this, you know, look, we're fighting the quote-unquote Great Satan, we're fighting the United States, because that's a whole different ballgame. And I don't think that has worked out very well for anybody, including the United States in the past. In the recent past, we have the examples in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I would fear if this very well-meaning hashtag campaign would be taken to create the basis of the kind of policies that have not been good in the past.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. We were speaking with a woman, a Nigerian woman in the capital, Abuja, last week, who was getting these frantic text messages from her sister, who was further north in Nigeria. And her sister was terrified about the arrival of Americans, clearly associating help from the West with kind of big danger, as in Afghanistan. If Americans go in, even if there are no boots on the ground, then there's going to be a ground war. That was kind of her connection.
Well, that's right. Part of the thing is, in the United States, we have this habit of starting history from yesterday, whereas the rest of the world has a longer memory. The Iraq War is not a long time ago. And yes, you know, we had a change in administration, but for most of the people around the world, they're just looking at previous Western interventions, and none of those ended well in recent history. So I'm not against the United States or United Kingdom or any other power doing reasonable steps that can help the Nigerian government as directed by the Nigerian government under an international framework. But if we just sort of go in almost expecting to be a Robocop to save the world, we're just going to make things worse for everyone involved.
Where do you think this leaves the average person outside Nigeria, though, who wants to do something?
The do something impulse, especially in crimes against humanity, is a great one. And what has to be realized is the real do something is between the crises. Once the crisis hits, whatever international mechanisms we have put in place are the only ones we have. And the obvious problem is that we don't have enough and they're not functioning in a healthy way. You know, whenever something happens, we just turn to big powers and say, oh, could you do something? Maybe could your military do something? Well, you know, this is the problem. The do something, the impulse needs to be taken and applied between the crises so that the next time something horrible happens, and unfortunately, horrible things will happen in the future. They've happened in the past. This doesn't start with the hashtag, doesn't end with when the hashtag stops trending. There's a lot to be done. There's a lot to be done to support girls' education worldwide. There's a lot to be done to create the kind of international structures that can deal with these kinds of problems. There's a lot to help Nigerians. There's a lot to help us. It's just the moment of crisis is usually the worst one to try to do something new, because if you don't have the tools by then, you know, your house is flooded, your house is on fire, and you don't have the tools, you don't have the fire extinguisher, that doesn't put you in a good place. The question should be, how do we get our hands on a fire extinguisher for the next time?
I'm just curious, news you can use, Zeynep, to retweet or not to retweet? What do we do at this point?
I would retweet in the sense, I would say, let Nigerians handle this. I would try to have the conversation. Talking about it is not going to harm people, but asking, you know, our government that is not involved, you know, is not selected by Nigerians, just do something. It sounds reasonable. You know, we're a powerful country. Shouldn't we be able to do something? But once again, given the history and given the context, that's not the best impulse. Our question should be, how do we create a world in which something can be done? And that's just not going to happen overnight.
Zeynep Tufekci at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks very much, as always.
Thank you.
Africa, of course, is a hugely diverse and complex place. Yet when thinking about Africa, many book illustrators come up with the same image, a lone acacia tree with a burnt orange sky or sunset as background, and maybe an elephant silhouette. There you go. That's Africa. Simon Stevens of Columbia University called this phenomenon out. He posted a collage of 36 different book covers with that exact image. Illustrations for stories by a variety of different authors, from Joseph Conrad to Barbara Kingsolver. Neelika Jayawardena couldn't help but laugh when she saw the collage. She grew up in Zambia and is now an associate professor of postcolonial literature at SUNY Oswego in upstate New York. And she's an editor at Africa as a Country. So you teach postcolonial literature?
I do. And so many of the book covers that my students buy and read have those book covers, and they must negotiate with the view that that book cover presents, their pre-existing views, and then what's in the covers. Much of the semester is spent renegotiating their understanding of this complex place rather than the book cover version that they already come into contact with all their lives and then that the book covers sort of reinforce.
So I can only imagine what went through your mind when you actually saw 36 different book covers all together. I mean, it's kind of a mind blower.
I was so surprised, but in a way, you know, it wasn't that much a shock because whether it's Nigeria or South Africa, Mozambique, Botswana or Zambia, it's that same kind of distended belly of the setting sun with the acacia. And I have to say that I grew up with that very acacia tree, a gigantic shading tree outside of my home. So it's not that it doesn't exist, but it's not the only thing that exists in Southern Africa or in East Africa.
How do these publishers manage to keep a lock on the world supply of orange and ochre and beige ink? That's what I want to know.
I wish I knew. I mean, we can't even find it. All my painter friends complain about the fact that they can't find that. They can't find orange anymore. Yeah.
Neelika, for you, what is the one image of Africa you've never seen on a cover which must have its day someday on a book?
I keep coming back to there's a photograph that I have of me in sixth grade, and it's with I have a British teacher who's come there. He's wearing a tie and a white shirt, and all of us sixth grade kids are lined up under him. And there's a couple of British kids, several Indian kids, one kid with he's Sikh, he's got a turban, and one of them is wearing a bow tie because that was a special day for photographs. And I look at us and I remember, this is my view, and it's a complex view of what Africa is. And I think, oh, this is the image I think of when I think of my school. And I want that kind of a school child's picture that isn't about a fraught school child in danger of being kidnapped by Boko Haram or whatever, because I grew up in enormous safety and with enormous, like, kind of competitive spirit about our academics and a lot of, like, love about learning. And I don't think that many people imagine that as an African scene or an African everyday.
Neelika Jayawardena, thank you very much for speaking with us. Great to meet you.
Oh, you too. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Still ahead on The World, what does your city map smell like? On PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's not the opening scene from the movie The Day After Tomorrow, you know, where a giant chunk of Antarctica suddenly slides into the ocean, triggering a global climate catastrophe. But the fact that the massive West Antarctic ice sheet is starting to collapse, That's sobering, to say the very least. Two new studies out this week say the collapse may be slow, but it's unstoppable now and will contribute to rising sea levels. Robert Binshadler is a retired Antarctic field researcher with NASA. He says the studies on the West Antarctic ice sheet confirm what he and other scientists suspected for some time.
What we've been worried about is this eventual collapse. And we were always concerned, are we witnessing the opening chapter of this collapse? We didn't know how to recognize that. But these studies really are the best evidence we have that, in fact, we are witnessing right now the opening chapter of this collapse.
And what do these studies rely on? How do we know this ice sheet is collapsing?
The one study that talks about the continuing retreat of the grounded ice sheet and where the floating ice shelf begins, that relies entirely on satellite data, which are our best data sources for monitoring what the ice sheet is doing. The other study, which models how this collapse would evolve in the future, makes use of not just satellite data, but also field data that have been collected over the years that give us a better understanding of how the dynamics of this ice sheet work and how the ocean is driving this retreat.
One key part of that dynamic is this idea that this is a runaway train. This is unstoppable. Is that fair?
That's right. And that's, I think, the real alarm that these two papers highlight. There is likely no stopping of this phenomenon now. And it's because these glaciers, when they retreat, when they're a glacier that sits on a bed below sea level, so the ocean always has access to the edge of the ice sheet, it can pause and be quasi-stable if it's sitting on a high spot in the bed, if the edge of the ice sheet is kind of hanging on to a high spot in the bed, and then it will retreat rapidly to the next high spot in the bed upstream. Well, there are no high spots left. That's what makes this retreat unstoppable.
So we're talking as much as a 12-foot sea level rise over the next few hundred years because of the collapse of this ice sheet. When is it possible we might start feeling some of the effects of this?
We're feeling the effects right now. I mean, this area of the Antarctic ice sheet is contributing to the current rate of sea level rise, which, including all sources, is about a little bit over 3 millimeters per year. The disturbing part is that this is an accelerating trend. This ice sheet is going to be losing mass faster and faster and faster. So the rate of sea level rise is going to be increasing.
And just for a reminder for scale, in an extreme event like Superstorm Sandy, that represented what kind of height of sea rise for the people along the Jersey Shore?
The concern is that sea level rise just raises the launching pad for everything bad that the ocean does, tidal waves, the storm surges, the hurricanes. So Superstorm Sandy, which raised seas, I think, a meter or more in the New York City area, just would be launched from a higher launching pad.
Right.
Rising sea level is just going to make all those storms more damaging because sea level will be higher.
What about East Antarctica? It's much bigger and a lot more ice. What's happening there?
East Antarctica is about 10 times larger. But one can't forget about the Greenland ice sheet, too, because it's presently contributing at least as much to sea level as the Antarctic ice sheet is right now. So there are lots of ice sheets to be worrying about right now. Greenland and West Antarctica, I think, are leading the list.
Robert Binshadler, glaciologist and a retired Antarctic field researcher with NASA, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Tough looking for a silver lining to the climate story, but there might be one, for some people anyway, in this next story. Yesterday, we told you how climate change could threaten champagne production in France. Today, the potential flip side. Reporter Fawn Keim crosses the English Channel to southern England to tell us about the rocky birth of a sparkling wine industry there.
It's harvest week at Ridgeview Winery, and migrant workers snip picture-perfect clusters of plump, juicy Pinot and Chardonnay. Ridgeview has become internationally respected for its sparkling wine, especially since winning the only contest in the world to judge other sparkling wines and champagne together.
There's some amazing wines there, you know, world famous, and then there's us, Ridgeview.
Winemaker Simon Roberts says he'll never forget that moment.
And as we walked up, we actually got a standing ovation, and it was amazing.
The truly amazing part was that this sparkling wine was from England. South Downs, to be exact. Hardly a place known for its fine wine. But the climate here is warming, and that's brought some big changes where viticulture is concerned.
Climate change has done a lot of things. Mainly it's changed the grape varieties we grow.
That's British author and vineyard consultant Stephen Skelton.
So 40 years ago, we could never have envisaged growing Pinot Noir and Chardonnay successfully.
But climate change has helped make that possible. Skelton says that the area under vine in England has doubled since 2003. And most of these new vines are for sparkling wine. But the days of English sparkling wine growers being the scrappy underdogs are hardly over. Because the weather here hasn't just been warmer, it's also been weirder.
And millions of people in England and Wales have been told to prepare for hurricane-force gusts.
Just as England's grape harvest was getting started last fall, residents were being warned about a massive storm headed straight for southern England. It was the latest in an unusual series of storms in recent years.
In the UK, we've had 6 bad summers in a row between 2007 and 2012.
Jeff Knight is a climate scientist at the UK's weather agency called the Met Office. He says scientists are studying whether there's a link between this bizarre weather and climate change elsewhere in the world.
There's been very substantial reduction in sea ice since about 2007. Roughly at the same time, the UK started experiencing its very wet summers. So it's tempting to suggest a connection between these two things.
Others aren't so sure, but while the research continues, the impact of all of this wet weather on the grapes is clear. As he oversees the harvest, Ridgeview's vineyard manager Matt Strugnell says rain is one of the worst things that can happen during the harvest.
If there's excess water in the ground, the vines will take that up and then it can dilute the juice in the berries.
Quality aside, bad weather can just destroy a whole season of hard work. Simon Roberts says that happened to everyone here in 2012, when extreme cold and rain in the spring devastated the vines.
Basically, it had very poor flowering, so there wasn't much fruit. And then summer forgot to arrive, and autumn came and harvest came. But it was very, very difficult.
That was 2012. Fortunately, last fall's harvest wasn't a repeat of that disaster. Of course, as a farmer, Roberts knows weather will always bring surprises. But what climate change giveth here in warming, it also seems to taketh away in even more uncertainty. Still, vineyard manager Matt Strugnell says Ridgeview will keep doing everything it can to produce top-quality sparkling wine in England, despite the more unpredictable weather. Among other things, that will mean keeping an eye on their rivals across the English Channel in France to see how growers in Champagne deal with climate change.
We still have a very similar sort of situation here in terms of growing conditions, and they may see the change a bit earlier. So if they start running into difficulties, you know, they're saying, oh, it's getting too hot, we would probably have a few years after that to take that on board.
For The World, I'm Fawn Keim, South Downs, England.
Fawn's story was produced in partnership with the online news service, The Daily Climate. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, a London restaurant recreates a Bombay cafe from the 1940s and combines Indian flatbread with an old English favorite.
They combine a little bit of bacon inside this naan, add a little bit of cream cheese and herbs, but then going back to the Indian side, some chili tomato jam.
Salty, sweet, and spicy. That's just ahead.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping build more resilient communities by supporting the American Red Cross so it can be ready to provide assistance whenever and wherever disasters occur. Learn how you can make a difference at AmericanRedCross.org. And from TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Frankly, I feel lucky to have been in college when posting pictures on the internet wasn't yet a thing. As it is, the analog photos continue to be humbling reminders of late adolescence. Today, it's a whole different ballgame, though. We voluntarily post information about ourselves, a lot of it, on the web. And if, say, in a few years, I don't want that picture I posted 5 years ago to be available, tough luck. In Europe, though, things are changing. A top European court ruled today that individuals there can ask search engines to remove online data about them. It's also known as the right to be forgotten. So as you can imagine, that's caused a lot of head turns in the digital and privacy world. Jonathan Zittrain is a professor of law at Harvard Law School. He also co-founded the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Professor Zittrain, tell us more about this decision by the European High Court today. What does it actually mean for all of us?
Well, This decision started, and there's a number of cases, but this is one particular case in which a Spanish citizen did not like the fact that a foreclosure that had happened years ago, because he hadn't paid his debts properly, was something that could be found if you searched under his name. And he asked both the original source of the document to take it down, and he asked Google not to index it anymore. And Google declined to do that, and he brought suit under the 1995 Data Protection Directive of the European Union. And I think to many experts' surprise, the EU's highest court just essentially backed him up. And we're still trying to figure out exactly the parameters of the ruling, but it sounds like if you have a problem with what gets returned on a search that involves your name, then you can ask a search engine like Google to remove it. And they don't always have to remove it, but whether or not they do is a complicated question that involves balancing various rights. So I would imagine that in wake of this ruling, many search engines will, if it doesn't change, start just taking stuff down, at least for results on searches on your own name.
Hmm. So what kind of information can be deleted, and won't future debates on this all turn on what kind of information comes out in a search?
Well, if you were hoping to have the answer to that question of what kind of information needs to be subject to the citizen's right to delete, if you were going to look to the court's opinion for answers, you would come up empty-handed. Mm. The opinion is not clear at all. To me, it's not even clear if this fellow actually has the right to have his foreclosure removed. And it's striking to me that in the press release that the court issued about its own opinion, it names the guy and the fact that he was foreclosed upon. And I don't know if what that means is if Google were to index the very press release under the guy's name, would the guy have a right to have that taken out as a result on the search? So I imagine it has to do with information that is from the past, maybe at one point was deemed relevant, but is less so because so many years have passed, is something that is embarrassing or unpleasant to the person it concerns and for which there's no particular great public reason to have it associated with that person. If that's my best shot at trying to describe what it is. But again, there's not much of a roadmap in this particular opinion.
This decision came from the European High Court. Could you see something like this happening in the U.S., a similar decision?
I do not. There might be instances at which you could see courts stepping in to say X piece of information needs to come down or there's damage if you leave it up. But we have a much stronger track record of first not blaming intermediaries so much for that which they index. So search engines do pretty well here. And we have the First Amendment, which there are plenty of things in Europe that would not pass First Amendment muster, including in Germany, it's illegal to display neo-Nazi sentiments or symbols. Mm. And that's why for years, Google.de on request will take down links to neo-Nazi websites that if the government were to try to order that here, it would not be allowed. The First Amendment would stop that.
One opinion from the European High Court, but a lot of questions that follow. Harvard University's Jonathan Zittrain, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Marco.
You know, one thing that's hard to keep private? A smell. And that brings us to our weekly Sideways Glance segment. It's a space we carve out on the show for our quirkier stories. This week's entry, to be honest, is more of a sideways sniff. It's about someone who pays very close attention, not only to what we smell, but where we smell it. Here's independent producer Sarah Reynolds with the story.
What city can you smell?
Garlic bread here.
Garlic bread and bug spray.
It's sewage.
And maybe calamari.
We're walking through the North End, an Italian neighborhood in Boston. These may not be the kinds of things you'd notice on an average city tour, but this tour, it's a smell walk. We're just using our noses.
It takes a lot of concentration to use your nose when you don't normally use it in that way.
Kate McLean is our guide. She laughs easily and wears a dark brown fedora.
I'm going to be really safety conscious here because one of the things that happens is you end up concentrating a lot on smell. So if I say stop or go, go is when you should be crossing the road.
She's conducted these smell walks in different parts of the world over the past several years. For her, they're sensory research trips. Today, she's collecting data so that she can map Boston by smell.
what I'm very interested in is other people's perceptions of place by smell and then aggregating that to form smell maps.
Kate's a graphic designer by trade. She's already smell mapped Edinburgh, Glasgow, Paris, Amsterdam, Milan, and one aromatic block in New York City. These maps are colorful interpretations of what a smell is doing in a particular place.
They're an attempt to make something visual that is ephemeral.
Take newly cut grass, for example. She smells it near a park, so on the map, there's a green dot in the park to represent the source of it. Then around the dot are flowing contour lines of the same color that show the strength or the range of that newly cut grass smell. The 10 of us weave through the aromas of the neighborhood. There's a lot to smell on this block. I'm getting garlic and pavement and rubber tires.
It smells really smoky, I've noticed, a lot of places. Not bad, just smoky.
Like a cooking smoke?
Yeah, cooking smoke, not like cigarette smoke. I'm hungry now.
Lisa Johnson is a food blogger. Some of the smellers are Kate's graphic design students, and then me trying to capture smell in sound. Each of us has a sheet of paper with our mapped walk and room for notes. What do we smell as we walk, and how strong is the odor? All data for Kate's map.
Okay, we are going to go up to here and cross safely.
We turn into a less populated area.
It's also much quieter on this street, so it's sort of easier to smell somehow because you're not, there's less to see.
We walk down an alley with window air conditioners humming. We take in the salt air of the waterfront, the smoke of cigarettes, a hit of strong cologne. It's overwhelming to pay so much attention to it.
I think it's something like we breathe 240,000 times a day. So there's 240,000 opportunities for us to smell something every day, which when you think about it is insane.
Kate wanted to see whether smell really mattered to people, if it impacted us in relation to memory and place. She started smelling places more closely, talking with local residents and smell experts and leading smell walks. One of the first smell maps Kate designed was of Paris.
The smells there were cheese, wine, rain, Yves Saint Laurent perfume, because Parisian women take that away with them to remind themselves of Paris and where they come from.
Then Edinburgh.
One of the smells was the boys' toilets in primary schools. And another one was the newly cut grass with a lot of the golf courses that actually are in the city. And the domineering smell of Edinburgh is actually the brewery and the malt fumes from that.
When Kate has exhibitions of her work, she recreates the smells from the maps in small bottles. So if you're looking at her map of Glasgow, you could pick up a bottle to take in the oily sponges and soaking rusty nails, the smell of the subway.
There's something about sort of saying, well, okay, you smell that, but what do I smell? We have specific memories of places and smells that are very, they're personal to us. They're part of the picture that we build up of a place. It has visual elements, but it also has olfactory elements.
We arrive at Faneuil Hall, a busy outdoor market in Boston lined with bars, and Kate catches a scent, one I wasn't expecting.
Like, whoa, I love that smell. This is like the smell of sewers. I actually really like it. Smells like that are proof that there's life, there's people. We're creating smells, but then they'll disappear into the environment that we're making them. It's evidence of life, I think. It's humanity.
For The World, I'm Sarah Reynolds, Boston.
Proof of life, from cherry blossoms to boys' toilets. You can see some of Kate McLean's colorful smell maps at PRI.org. Any smell map of London would include the scent of curry. London's got a solid reputation for Indian food. It should. Britain spent more than a century ruling India, so the British capital better know a thing or two about good Indian fare. But you don't think of the typical Indian restaurant in London as classy or expensive. Well, food writer Steve Dolinsky is just back from across the pond, and he's sampled some of the more upscale Indian restaurants in London, places that are now picking up their share of Michelin stars. And Steve says these restaurants are both classy and expensive.
I mean, we're talking $130 tasting menu, six courses. One of these places I went to called Benares, which is in the Mayfair area, very posh, next to a Rolls-Royce dealership, if that gives you any indication. Super sophisticated servers in suits carving tandoori, whole tandoori chickens, table side that are rubbed in red chili. Really beautiful presentation. And all these places have one thing in common. They all have interior decorators, because I've never seen Indian restaurants so beautiful like I saw when I was in London. But really, really elegant presentation.
So the most interesting place you ran across is a place called Dishoom. Tell us about it and how they kind of take Indian food beyond what we usually know about Indian food.
Yeah, Dishoom is really, really interesting. So it's based on these Irani cafes that came from the old Aryan Irani chai khanas, literally tea houses. They could be found along the Aryan trading routes. And so I spoke with the owner, Shamil Takrar, and we talked a little bit about kind of where this tradition came from.
So Iranians have been coming to Bombay for centuries, but a recent wave of immigration in the early 20th century were called the Iranis, and they subsequently set up cafes in Bombay. There were maybe 400 or 500 of these cafes by the 50s or 60s, but sadly now they've died out. These places have enormous affection in Bombayites' hearts. People love them.
You said these cafes are also known for being totally democratic. You'd have a taxi driver next to a prostitute, next to a politician.
Indeed, that's right. And I think that, I mean, in a way, these cafes, because of when they were started in the early 20th century, they were some of the first places that people went out to eat as leisure. That wasn't really done before in India, unless you were very wealthy, you know, a kind of white person ruling. But these spaces, as a result, became very welcoming of all sorts of people. And because of the Iranis were outsiders, they welcomed everybody. It wasn't a Hindu place, it wasn't a Muslim place. They were kind of outsiders, so everyone could come in, and they didn't have any problems with letting everyone in.
That's Shamil Takrar, the owner of Dishoom, the restaurant in London. Steve, I had no idea about this Bombay connection with Iran, former Persia. It's kind of an Iranian snack bar adapting Bombay cooking. I mean, is it a snack bar in appearance in London?
No, they've really give you the sense that they have picked up a cafe from the 1940s or 50s and transported it to London. The beautiful tiles on the floor, the sort of worn wooden chairs, the lazy ceiling fans up above. So clearly they spent money on the design, but in terms of the prices, very reasonable. And you're talking, you know, $5 to $15 for many of these items. So in the morning, you'd have a bun masca, very simple. It's an Irani cafe classic, just kind of a toasted hot bun outside, slices of butter inside, dipped into some spicy chai. That's it. But they're really known for this bacon naan roll. So this is where naan, obviously the ubiquitous flatbread you see in every Indian restaurant, and they bake these to order. But because you're in London, they're known for bacon sandwiches. And so they combine a little bit of bacon inside this naan, add a little bit of cream cheese and herbs, but then going back to the Indian side, some chili tomato jam. So you kind of have that sweet to counteract that that richness, that fattiness from the cream cheese. And this is something that costs $5.
I doubt the Iranian pedigree of this restaurant would have endorsed the bacon naan.
They probably wouldn't have, but this is what Shamil really prides himself on, that they've taken this concept and then they've adapted it, you know, for the London audience, because they certainly bring, you know, a little bit of British into it. Just little things like, you know, berries you'd see in Persia. Very, very important to have barberries, but you can't find those in London. So they're going to put cranberries in one of their dishes. So they make little adjustments to kind of adapt for the local audience.
All right, Steve, I'm going to put you on the spot. Best thing you had in any of these Indian places you ate at in London?
I had this incredible lunch at Moti Mahal, which is near Covent Garden. Really elegant lunch. I had a couple of things. A little baby chicken that was rubbed in red chili spices, cooked in the tandoor, and then a green chili braised rabbit, which I'd never seen in an Indian restaurant before. But, of course, everything there better with, you know, a beautiful raita, that cooling yogurt, some basmati rice, a little bit of paratha or naan, and then some cumin-spiked cauliflower. And then to drink, instead of a Kingfisher beer, honestly, I would have something like a German Riesling or Gewürztraminer, which really counteracts that spicy food well.
Steve, you know how to live, man. I want to be you just for one day.
All right. We'll figure something out, man. I can work on that.
Food writer Steve Dolinsky, just back from London, where he's been sampling some pretty upscale Indian food. Great to speak with you, Steve. Thank you.
You too, Marco. Thanks.
Steve sent us mouth-watering photos of some of those dishes he mentioned. Seriously, get the bacon on your naan and get your bacon naan on. Swing by our website, PRI.org. You're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. There's standing up for yourself, and then there's picking a fight you're likely to lose. Vietnam may have done the latter when it sent some of its Navy ships to confront Chinese ships in a disputed section of the South China Sea. The Vietnamese were furious that China had set up an oil rig in an area claimed by both countries. Each side accused the other of ramming its vessels. The skirmish has become a major topic of conversation in Vietnam, across social media, at protest rallies, in classrooms, and even cafes. Reporter Christopher Johnson set out to hear what people make of the standoff in the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi.
The sun's finally gone down on this 117-degree day, and everybody's outside. So it's easy to find people who have something to say about China, but not so easy to find someone who'll do it on tape. At a busy sidewalk beer spot, Phuong Thi Thinh needs a few sips before she's ready to get real.
A lot of people have been discussing about this issue on Facebook, and many of them are furious. They show a very clear hatred towards the Chinese government, and some of them are even talking about fighting against China.
She's right about Facebook. Pages are filling up with vitriol aimed squarely at the Chinese government. Folks are posting patriotic images of Vietnamese soldiers strapped and ready for battle. There are the China Get Out banners and endless comment strings crammed with earnest patriotism, finger-wagging history lessons, and genuine fear. Vietnamese folks have a lot to say about this conflict. Some of Tu Vu To's friends are so angry with China, they're talking about a potential fight.
My friends and I, whenever we meet up, we all talk about it. We are watching the news every second of the day to see what's happening. And some people are so enthusiastic that they talk about volunteering to protect our islands and seas.
Now, this whole thing with the Chinese oil rig is going down almost 150 miles offshore. But the way folks like To are talking, it'd be easy to think there was an imminent threat to mainland Vietnam.
It's hard for me to explain why Vietnamese people are reacting this way, because I feel it's a very natural reaction. When someone invades your house, you have to show that you are the owner, and you are not letting them do that to you or your house.
Vietnamese people are very concerned about their territory.
Dang Tan is a Vietnamese novelist and poet. What are known as the Paracel Islands, not far from where the rig is, are officially part of disputed territory, but the Vietnamese say this is our turf.
All the people here are very sensitive to anything relating to border and, territory.
Vietnam's relationship with China has been fraught long before this latest flare-up. Lots of wars over the last few centuries, and so it's not too shocking that some folks here see China's oil rig throwdown as a bully move. And then there's the question of war. Novelist Dang Tan doesn't want to fight, but he says the way for Vietnam to avoid an armed conflict isn't by backing down.
Vietnamese government need to be harder. I don't think the Chinese will carry out war when other people showing their determination. I think the Chinese will, move back.
But whether or not China relents, people like Phuong Thi Nguyen say they're not intimidated by their neighbor's military might. At a Mother's Day party, Nguyen and her girlfriends talked about the prospect of war.
Nobody wants this to happen, from government to normal people like us. But if it happens, I'm ready. Maybe not directly, but indirectly, if my husband and my family have to join the army, I support them 100%.
But despite the bravado, like all of the other wives and moms at this table, like most of Vietnam, Nguyen hopes no one in her house is ever called up. For The World, I'm Christopher Johnson in Hanoi.
Finally, it's a grim day for fans of dark art. The godfather of the form, H.R. Giger, died yesterday after a fall, age 74. The Swiss artist christened his style biomechanical. Think alien, the face-sucking, body-inhabiting kind. H.R. Giger was the artist and designer for the monster and many of the sets in Ridley Scott's 1979 classic.
His designs completely transformed the idea of the monster in gothic science fiction films.
Roger Luckhurst is writing a book on Alien for the British Film Institute.
beforehand, it had always just been really a very laughable man in a rubber suit. And Ridley Scott saw, as soon as he saw H.R. Giger's paintings, saw that he'd got the monster that he really wanted and was completely astounded. And of course, it has completely changed the conception of what scares you in science fiction monster films now.
But H.R. Giger was much more than the creative genius behind a movie monster, even if it did get him an Oscar. His art inspired a generation of talented creative monsters, writers like William Gibson and Neil Gaiman, filmmakers like Guillermo del Toro, and swarms of hoodie-clad game designers. By the way, the name is Giger, even though a lot of people call him Geiger. His own influences? How about the cult horror fiction writer H.P. Lovecraft?
Lovecraft was not really very well known until the 1960s, but it was through people like H.R. Giger who published a book called The Necronomicon, The Book of the Dead, which actually was his illustrations for H.P. Lovecraft. And really, I think it's through H.R. Giger's influence in the 70s that Lovecraft became such a major influence on American popular culture now.
Or at least a certain slice of American popular culture. But Lucker says H.R. Giger reached inside for inspiration as well.
He always talked about dredging up his images from his unconscious, and there really is no subtext in his paintings. It's all text, incredibly sexualized, but also terrifying images of machines combined with, usually with women's bodies, actually. So, and he talked about how all of these ideas came from traumatic images or memories from his nightmares. So those images, very sexualized images, became very popular in the 1970s.
Giger once said his paintings seemed to make the strongest impression on people who are, well, crazy. Lockhurst says despite his popularity, Giger always felt that he never got the recognition he deserved. And yet he lived in extravagant Gothic splendor in a castle in Switzerland.
He was an extraordinary, very eccentric figure, wonderful kind of descendant from that Dali surrealism. He's not really considered in fine art world to be, as it were, a proper artist, a bit like Salvador Dali. But actually, in the popular culture, he's exactly what people want an artist to be. Very eccentric, always dressed in black leather, always behaving in a very odd and eccentric way, always muttering darkly about death, sex and despair. What more do you want?
Artist and designer H.R. Giger died yesterday from a fall. He was 74. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund. Donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. RitaAllen.org. By the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.